Welcome back. For those of you joining just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show, and you can find out more information on our website. Go to kalw.org, click on news, and you'll see our program, Your Call, listed there. And that's where you can find our past shows and sign up for our newsletter so you can find out what's coming up next and never miss a show, or at least those topics that you want to hear more on. If you have a show idea for us, drop us a line. The email address is yourcall@kalw.org, and you can call us anytime at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, now we're going to discuss the Trump administration's unprecedented attack against people who have protested against its policies. New reporting from Adam Federman, our guest, examines the trial of 9 individuals recently convicted on federal charges, including, quote, material support for terrorism by a jury in Texas. The case stems from a noise demonstration that escalated into an exchange of gunfire at the Prairieland Detention Center. Adam Federman is an award-winning journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. He's written widely on environmental policy, public lands, and corporate and police spying on environmental activists. He's also written for Politico magazine, The Washington Post, Wired, Slate, The Nation, and other publications, and the author of Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray. Adam, good to have you back with us, and thank you for your reporting on this issue.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan. It's great to be here.
So, Adam, there's a lot been going on in the news, and this is a story that's very easy to sort of overlook, but it has really potentially monumental significance, which we'll talk about. So you wrote about a trial connected to a protest that took place last July outside of the Prairieland ICE Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas. It holds about 1,000 detainees by ICE here. Can you talk a bit just about what happened on that day?
Sure. I mean, this is a protest that, as you said, took place on July 4th, 2025. And at the time, it really just flew under the radar. It was a small gathering, about a dozen activists who decided to stage what's called a noise demonstration in front of the Prairieland Detention Center at about 11 p.m. So they set off some fireworks, and things kind of went off the rails. There was some vandalism, and a police officer arrived on the scene after being called by officials inside of the facility. And when he got there, he pulled his gun, and some shots were exchanged. A small number of the activists had brought some guns to the protest, which is not terribly uncommon in Texas. The police officer was hit just below the neck, and the shooter, a former Marine reservist by the name of Benjamin Song, ended up sort of on the run for about 11 days. So there was this long manhunt for him. And, you know, as part of that dragnet, a number of activists who were both at the protest and affiliated with it were arrested and charged with a variety of crimes. And it took on greater significance in the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk and the Trump administration's designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. And the reason why this trial has taken on such national significance is that the Trump administration has sort of used it as the poster child for its crackdown on Antifa and the left more broadly.
Yeah, this really feels like the crux of it, using this sort of domestic terrorism approach to what otherwise might be a fairly run-of-the-mill disturbance type. I mean, not to minimize what happened there, but, you know, otherwise not really something that could have a significant First Amendment implications. Can you talk about now how the Charlie Kirk shooting murder fits into this, and the domestic terrorism charges? How did they play out? How did both of those dynamics play out now in the trial that resulted?
Yeah, I mean, it was really instrumental in terms of characterizing this protest as a part of a larger conspiracy with Antifa at its, you know, sort of at the heart of the whole thing. I mean, the protest, as we said, took place on July 4th. The assassination of Charlie Kirk a couple of months later, in September, and a few weeks after Kirk's assassination, There were a number of actions taken by the Trump administration to target and sort of go after, you know, what they characterize as the radical left and Antifa in particular. So the executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, which many experts have pointed out has zero legal meaning, but it's part of the administration's broader sort of narrative about the threat that that this group supposedly poses.
Can you describe who these protesters were, especially those who were involved in the trial and ultimately, you know, found guilty in this verdict?
Right. It's probably helpful to back up a little bit. There were 9 defendants facing federal trials in this particular case. They also face state-level charges as well. A handful of defendants took plea deals and cooperated with the government. And then there are about 9 or 10 activists who were not present at the protest who were also arrested and currently face charges. I mean, they're part of a loose network of activists in the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Many of them were part of a sort of an anarchist book club called the Emma Goldman Book Club. Some knew each other, some did not. And this was one of many protests staged outside of ICE detention centers, both in Texas and elsewhere across the country. So there wasn't really anything particularly unusual about the event itself.
And I guess just for additional context, let's talk about who was being held in this detention center, what it was about. We know that there was a Palestinian woman from New Jersey who was arrested during a protest at Columbia University in 2024, who was released from Prairie Land after spending a year there and said that the conditions were, quote, horrible. She had had a seizure and was hospitalized while in custody this February. Can you talk a bit about what you have been able to report on in terms of Prairie Land and the types of people who are being detained there?
That's right. You're referring to Laka Cordia, the young Palestinian woman who had been detained there for just about a year and was released right around the time that the trial wrapped up. In fact, I don't know a great deal about the Prairie Land Detention Center in particular, but it had been used to house immigrant detainees who were being deported to different destinations in South America. Texas ICE detention centers and prisons are notorious for their terrible conditions, including the jails that many of the activists have been in since the July 4 protest. And I guess one thing I would point out in the course of my reporting on the Prairie Land trial, when I was down in Fort Worth, I did do some interviews with members of the Muslim American community there who, you know, explained in detail the impact that ICE and the ICE crackdown has had on, you know, their community leaders, a handful of whom have been detained and in some cases deported. So these two threads are sort of happening on parallel tracks. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Adam Federman, award-winning journalist, reporting fellow with Type Investigations. His recent piece, FBI Files Counter-Government Argument in Texas Antifa Trial, details the trial of anti-ICE protesters in Fort Worth, Texas, which is a subject of our show here today on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. If you have questions about this case, what it means for peaceful protesters in the United States against Trump administration policies, what kind of precedent this could be setting using domestic terrorism charges against protesters, how that might affect all of our First Amendment rights, the number to call to talk to us, to talk to listeners, to ask questions of Adam Federman is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us with your questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Adam, let's talk about Antifa. First of all, how did they end up linking these protesters to Antifa? Why does the administration seem so obsessed with Antifa? That seems like such common rhetoric from the right wing. Give us more picture here of what's happening with Antifa and this particular case.
Yeah, well, it's important to underscore just how central Antifa was to the trial and the prosecution's case against these individuals. And it also is relevant to the the story that I published a couple of weeks ago, which was based around these FBI records that were not included in discovery. I mean, the prosecution and its star witness, as well as a number of law enforcement officials and FBI agents who testified during the trial, essentially painted a picture of, Antifa as a large organized conspiracy, international in scope, that is bent on, you know, overthrowing the government and committed to sort of radical anarchist slash, you know, Marxist ideology. For the Trump administration, Antifa has come to stand in for essentially any kind of political philosophy that is, you know, opposed to what the Trump administration is doing. So in addition to the executive order that Trump issued in September of 2025 after Charlie Kirk's assassination, he also drafted this National Security Presidential Memorandum, NSPM-7, it's called, which is carries much more weight. And it lays out sort of a sweeping attack on, you know, anti-capitalist beliefs, beliefs or ideas that are opposed to sort of the traditional family. And it sort of wraps them all up in, you know, under the umbrella of the radical left or Antifa. So I think that although this case focuses on a very particular, you know, protest and it was a immigration-related action, the Trump administration's objectives are much, much bigger. And I think that's really the lens through which we have to understand this case. And, you know, they've taken their victory lap, since the convictions were handed down back in March. And there have been reports in the last couple of weeks about a planned summit this summer in D.C. with government officials from around the world sort of to strategize around battling Antifa. And I think, you know, in the run-up to the November elections and beyond, this is going to be a focus of you know, the Trump administration's, the remainder of its first term.
Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens with that summer event, but what are your sort of predictions about what might happen with the Trump administration and conservatives' use of Antifa as this kind of boogeyman? What do you think they're cooking up at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've seen some indications that they have instructed law enforcement, including the Joint Terrorism Task Force's state and local police departments, to investigate these so-called networks. And because the language is so vague, it remains sort of an open question what that's going to look like on the ground. I mean, we had the Prairie Land trial, but we haven't seen, beyond a few isolated arrests of you know, individuals involved in protest-related crime who they've branded as, you know, Antifa members, we haven't seen any kind of coordinated action taken to this point. But some have likened the period that we're living through to, you know, the Red Scare of the post World War II era, mm-hmm. crackdown on communist organizing and the Communist Party in the United States, and the Trump administration's effort to sort of undermine civic institutions, whether it's universities, media, nonprofits, etc., is, I think, part and parcel of this larger project. And, you know, I don't know how much public support it has. I don't know that people wake up fearing Antifa or fearing the radical left. So it's unclear to me whether they're going to be able to generate the kind of public support for their mission that perhaps in previous periods of American history was more sort of in the background.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, the Red Scare, I think, tapped into some widespread paranoia and fear among the public, and hard to see that being the same dynamic with Antifa. Want to let listeners know, this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Alkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're joined by Adam Fetterman, award-winning journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations. And we're talking about his coverage of a Texas trial against anti-ICE protesters using domestic terrorism charges, which could potentially have a major chilling effect on protests in the United States going forward and an exercise of First Amendment rights. If you have questions for Adam about the trial or about the state of protesting in the United States. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from John in Oakland who writes, what's next in the trial? Are they appealing the verdict? Adam, is there any update on what the next steps might be for the people who are convicted in Texas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's still early days, but a handful of motions were filed a couple of weeks after, in efforts to overturn the convictions. But the defendants won't be sentenced until mid-June, and my understanding is that a number of appeals will be filed once the sentencing comes down. So, you know, there are a number of questions related to how the trial was handled, to the omission of key evidence and information, and, you know, they all also face state level charges, which are just now, those trials are just now getting underway. So, I mean, there is, I think there is some cautious optimism that some of the convictions can be overturned and challenged, but it's going to be a long road ahead for sure.
Yes. And how easy was it in the trial to connect these protesters to Antifa? And I'm thinking about the precedent it might set for future protesters who might be charged under the similar domestic terrorism law. I know that the prosecution relied on the expert witness testimony of a director of a right-wing think tank, Center for Security Policy, that according to The Intercept is a far-right organization led by an anti-Muslim activist, Frank Gaffney, who is known for peddling conspiracy theories. Can you talk about how they were able to link these protesters to Antifa and what that might mean for, you know, future cases against protesters in the United States?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was, so I was there for just the last 2 days of the trial, the last day of testimony and then closing arguments. And I actually saw Kyle Scheidler, the so-called expert witness who they had returned to the stand on that last day of testimony and they went back through some of the, you know, evidence that they introduced during the trial, a lot of which centered around, you know, signal chats, photos of activists wearing black clothing, reading and distributing radical literature, including zines. I mean, it's all stuff that's protected by the First Amendment, but the prosecution's strategy was to turn this into a kind of national security threat. You know, that there was sort of a specter of violence and you know, terrorism underneath all of this, and that's what was sort of driving these individuals to do what they did. And I mean, it's somewhat ironic because the charges that the activists face really had very little to do, if anything, to do with Antifa, but the case that the prosecution made was really built around this idea, not just the prosecution, but the Trump administration as well, which made a lot of noise about the Prairie Land trial and has sort of turned it into a cause for the administration. So I think to your question about what this means, well, you know, they're going to use the same kinds of strategies to tie activists, organizations, nonprofits, funders, etc., to Antifa, and that will come with great legal and financial risk. And, you know, yes, this is the direction that we were already heading in with the crackdown on protest in this country, but now it's sort of ramping up to a level that is, very troubling.
Well, I think that's such an important point and really gets to the heart of where the concern is coming out of this case. So what do you see is happening next? Are there other trials in the works? Are there other charges being brought now? Are there other likely potential victims, basically, of these types of charges being brought forward?
We haven't seen similar charges on sort of, you know, domestic terror grounds brought by the DOJ. But what I think is happening is that the threat is out there that the administration is going to pursue, you know, anyone who participates in protest, that, you know, that perhaps veers into criminality. And you know, there are many, nonviolent direct action, of course, is a deliberate way of engaging in you know, of getting arrested, whether it's blocking traffic or trespassing, et cetera. And I do think that those relatively run-of-the-mill protest-related crimes could now be turned into acts of, you know, quote-unquote terrorism.
And well, such an important story. Adam Fetterman, journalist, reporting fellow with Type Investigations, thank you so much for your work covering this trial. Obviously a very alarming story about protest and First Amendment rights, but really appreciate you coming on Your Calls Media Roundtable to talk about what's happening.
Thanks so much, Ethan. Appreciate it.
Well, that is our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit our webpage on kalw.org. Click on news and you'll see Your Call listed there. You can also find us on podcast platforms like iTunes, where you can give us a review, which we would greatly appreciate. Follow us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback you might have to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.